This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hello, everybody. Welcome once again to another edition of Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. We're here each and every Saturday, and we hope by now you know we talk about the disease of addiction and the many roads available and open for recovery. That's what we're dedicated to, information to inform people that as grim prospect of addiction is, there are people, millions of them, who manage to achieve long-term successful sobriety. To that end, we think there's great power in hearing first-person accounts of success because too many people think it's impossible to get sober. It's not. It's not easy, but it's certainly not impossible. So we bring you Voices in Recovery. These are people that are at some stage living in sobriety. And we think, again, if you hear these stories, they can be helpful to people who are in a dark place right now. I say this a lot. All stories of addiction and recovery are the same, except they're different. So that's what we do periodically here on Recovery Radio. We offer these stories. And we have the great benefit of the sponsor of the program, Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, who have obviously world-class facilities and treated people for many years with addiction, but they now have an alumni association. And we benefit from that by having the alumni of that program on with us. And we wanted to reintroduce, because she's been on the program many times, Maggie Hunt to the show today. Maggie, among her duties here at Retreat, is the director of this alumni group. Hi, Maggie. Good to see you again.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
So did I get all that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that one of the highlights of alumni, too, in the world today, really, we focus a lot on the overdoses. Everybody wants to talk about how many overdoses, and we avoid the idea of recovery. So I think that alumni brings recovery into the forefront of our minds and shows that there is hope for everyone.
Yeah, you know, it just occurs to me another benefit of having a group like the alumni group is that we've rapidly, because of the situation with opiate, as you say, the overdose, the death toll, we're kind of missing, because of the catastrophic nature of the epidemic, we're again drifting away from the central question, mission here, which is to get people sober.
Right.
Well, obviously, you want to keep them alive because they can't get sober if they're dead. But it has overwhelmed us. So when you hear about an alumni group, you go, oh, you mean everybody doesn't die
right.
from this disease? Because that's the sense we're getting. So we're grateful for your work in the alumni group. It's a brilliant idea. You bring us your people. And you've got one for us today. Who is it?
Yeah, this is Laura. Laura comes to us from Florida. And I won't tell too much of her story because I want her to. But she is going to be a great host with us today.
So we welcome her. She's on the phone with us. Hi, Laura. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Yeah, we're terrific. So you heard that introduction. We know who you are in general. We know why you're here anyway. We don't know who you are. So we like to begin the program by giving our guests an opportunity to tell us just that. So tell us who you are.
All right. Well, my name is Laura, and I am from a small town in Pennsylvania called Carlisle. More specifically, Mount Holly. I know that's probably a little far from where this is being broadcast, towards South Central Pennsylvania. I am just a normal person, normal everyday girl. I'm 26 now, so I'm in my mid-20s, I guess you could say. I grew up in a nice family. Parents are still together. Not a ton of trauma of any kind in my childhood. I have a little sister, and everything was just nice for me growing up. I should mention that I grew up in an alcoholic family, but this doesn't necessarily dictate why I ended up where I ended up.
Mm-hmm.
But growing up was nice. I went to school, and I always did well in school. I got good grades. I was very interested in art. And I went to college even for a couple years for photography in the Harrisburg area, which was very nice. Had a nice time.
In fact, I am a little familiar with that area that you are from. First of all, Retreat's main campus is not all that far. They're in Lancaster and Carlisle. You're sort of in the heartland of what a lot of people jokingly refer to as Pennsyltucky. The middle of the state of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is as sort of country-ish as you can imagine. It's not the mean streets of some city. So I get what you're trying to say. You are, for all practical purposes, the all-American girl who winds up abusing drugs and alcohol, correct?
Yeah, you know, you would have never guessed, just looking at my childhood, that I would go to where I was.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know even as a young child, I would think about, like, oh, what do I want to be like in 10 years? And it definitely wasn't where I was in 10 years.
Mm. Nobody sets out to abuse drugs and alcohol. No, that's not a goal. It's just the result of some awful, awful circumstances. So, yeah, I get that. You know, well, you mentioned right at the top that there was alcoholism in the family, but you don't believe it shaped your decisions. Do you believe it had any factor in your decisions and what happened to you?
Well, I think there's something to be said for a predisposition genetically towards alcoholism, but I personally am not a doctor and can't speak to that. However, seeing that in my family steered me probably more away from alcohol and more toward other drugs, because I saw that loss of control and sort of the violence that comes with being very drunk. And I always sort of stayed away from alcohol for a very long time and decided to indulge in other drugs because I didn't want to be like what I had seen around me growing up.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a little older than you, which is a total lie. I'm a lot older than you. But I will say that I recognize that decision. And by the way, preferences are formed very early on. And just because we're talking about substance abuse doesn't mean those preferences aren't made, you know. I mean, in my generation, there were people who drank and there were people who smoked marijuana. And they weren't the same people. Very often they were different kinds of people. Your explanation of why you would stay away from alcohol and drift towards something else almost, you know, obviously makes sense. What were those decisions? Where did they lead you and at what age?
Well, I can say around 14, I was just getting into high school, and a good friend of mine, you know, I should probably say that I was very active in SCARE and a lot of anti-drug things when I was younger, and then I got into high school.
Yeah, let me interrupt you. That's the DARE program where they come into schools, the police and officials, and tell people the horrors of drug use. Why were you involved in that? How did you get involved in DARE?
I think it was just because of what I saw going on around me, and I wanted to make sure that that wouldn't happen to me or anyone else that I loved.
Okay. So then what happens? How do you go from a situation where, you know, you're in DARE and then you're experimenting? Tell us about that.
Well, I was 14, and I had a good friend who was doing the swim team with me, and I remember her telling me about how she had been smoking weed. And she seemed to be healthy and very well off, and she hadn't gone insane or killed anyone. And I figured, you know, what could possibly be the harm? And that curiosity crept up into the forefront of my brain to the point where I decided I would go home with her and try it one day.
And you were 14
when I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was 14.
Right.
And when I did, nothing terrible happened. Nothing terrible happened at all. No one died. There was no badness to it. I didn't even have the paranoia that a lot of people talk about.
Mm-hmm.
What I really felt was that I had arrived, and I had found the one thing that took me out of my social anxiety and my generalized anxiety, and that this is what I wanted to do every day for the rest of my life.
So let's take a moment and talk about this free-floating anxiety that you talk about, which, again, is another very, very common experience that I hear from people who wind up abusing drugs and alcohol. At 14 years of age, it's almost natural for a young girl to have anxiety. You're between being a child and an adult. You're anxious about boys, you're worried about the way you look, there are unique pressures on young girls in this society. What was different about your anxiety? Weren't all your friends anxious?
Well, I have actually anxiety disorder. generalized anxiety disorder since I was very young, and it might have something to do with being a child of an alcoholic. A lot can be said about that, and again, I'm not a psychiatrist and can't exactly go into that, but mm-hmm. I have a chemical imbalance that causes me to be very, very anxious at all times.
Really?
And it's gotten better as I've gotten older.
When was that diagnosed? How old were you?
Oh, very young, maybe like 5.
Oh, great. So marijuana must feel like a miracle drug when you experience it the first time, right?
Yeah.
And suddenly that feeling goes away. I can't tell you that. That's one of the most amazing things about this disease, is that it almost always begins with an effort to fill up some hole or to relieve some feeling of not fitting. Is that what your anxiety was like? I something's wrong and I can't put my finger on it?
Absolutely. And I actually found out when I was 17 that I had been diagnosed on the autism spectrum, not very just to be like a high-functioning type of autism. And I never fit in. I didn't have any friends, and I never understood why. And I was just very scared in all social situations and would cry a lot. And this made me feel like I couldn't fit in with anyone.
Yeah, our guest on telephone is Laura. Laura is a recovering substance abuser, and she is a member of the alumni group put together by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, who are sponsors of the program. That director of that program is with us as well in the studio, Maggie Hunt. We're going to continue with Laura's story, find out, you know, just how far down the road of substance abuse she goes, and we'll get her story of treatment as well straight ahead. You're listening to Recovery Radio. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano is my name. In the studio with us is Maggie Hunt. Maggie is with Retreat, and she is the director of their alumni program, which you know, sounds like something you think you might understand, an alumni group. Who don't understand that? But this is a little bit different. Maggie, you brought one of your people. We have her on the phone. Laura is telling us about her story. I begin this by saying all these stories are the same, but they're different. It really is that, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, Laura, thanks for hanging on there with us. Let's continue now. So, you know, your first taste of marijuana comes 14 years of age. Take us through your history of drug and alcohol abuse or drug abuse.
All right. Well, I will do it as short as I possibly can. But basically, I started smoking weed, and I felt that it was the best thing ever, and I never wanted to do anything without smoking it. So for me, it wasn't like I tried it on a weekend and did it the next weekend. I tried it and immediately found someone to sell it to me and smoked every single day after my first use up until I quit everything, because I couldn't do anything like anything less than 100%. So I discovered that, and then quickly through getting into that world and gaining those sorts of relationships with the people that were doing the same thing I was, I found something else. A bunch of pills really came next. Xanax, Adderall, different benzodiazepines. And I actually ended up overdosing on benzodiazepines when I was 15. And,
were the benzodiazepines prescribed to you because of your anxiety diagnosis?
They were not. I've never been prescribed them. Ever.
That's interesting.
That was just something I'd found through the people that I was hanging out with at the time.
You know what's interesting to me, and I want you to spend a minute to discuss your thoughts on it. And again, we know you're not an expert. You're just telling us your story. This progression people with a substance abuse disorder has about moving on to something else is interesting. Maybe it doesn't happen in all cases, but you say that your first experience with marijuana was very satisfying, and that you immediately began doing it as often as you could, right?
Yeah.
Why the step up? Why does that happen? And it always happens. When did marijuana, or did it, stop being enough for you?
You know, it wasn't really like that, because I would always smoke marijuana, but it was more like a Pandora's box had been opened. Like, oh, well, maybe everything I learned in health class was wrong, and maybe all these drugs won't kill me. And therefore, I figured I ought to try them all just to make sure.
Yeah, once the lie's revealed, than sort of like, oh, this has all been nonsense. I can do anything I want, right?
Yeah, basically. I just figured, well, this all seems to be wrong.
Well, the other thing that's interesting, and the reason I asked you to talk about this step up, because I know it doesn't end with just pills, right? We'll get to that. But, I mean, well, the reason I mention that is that it's important to point out to people who don't know the nature of this disease that when someone like Laura talks about she finds marijuana, it opens a door for her. She feels better, but suddenly it leads to other things. We're not talking about the specific drug she's using. It's really not about that. You want to say something, May?
Well, I was just thinking a lot about the stereotype that everybody believes, right, and that Laura's talking about. Oh, if I use drugs and alcohol, I will get hurt and I will die, right? That's what we're taught in school. That's what some of the, you know, prevention programs are. And like for Laura, you know, she didn't have that, you know, when she smoked weed, and she, you know, she didn't have that the first use for the next substance. And so as she continued to progress, I can see how why we believe the delusion, we believe the lie that it's not as bad as we've heard it to be our whole life.
That's pretty much the way it was for you, right, Laura?
Yes, and I think it's also worth mentioning that a lot of it had to do with I really just enjoyed being high.
Yes.
I enjoyed the lifestyle.
That's another thing that, you know, again, folks on the outside don't get. I mean, it's you enjoy that feeling. But again, what I want to hear you talk about is that what was wrong, if you'll pardon the expression, with you was that you had sort of an allergy you were not the kind of person that could just do marijuana. You were almost fated to wind up trying a lot of drugs. Is that the way you look at it?
Yeah, absolutely, because it's like I just wanted to feel not in myself all the time because I wasn't happy with who I was when there wasn't a drug in my body. And there wasn't a drug in my mind. I wasn't happy with who I was when I sat alone with myself completely sober. So I made sure to never, ever, ever put myself in a position where I was sitting alone completely sober.
When was the first time you overdosed? How old were you?
I was 15. I've actually only had one overdose, and it was on the benzodiazepines, and I was 15.
How was that treated? How was that handled?
To not get into too many gory details, involved me going to a hospital and then actually being transferred to a juvenile psych ward in Pennsylvania.
Right, right.
Because I was sort of saying some things that would get me to be forcibly put into a psych ward at that time.
Yeah. Benzodiazepines are very, very dangerous. Very dangerous.
Yeah.
That's another sort of consequence of the opiate epidemic is that it's overshadowed a lot of other problems that are going on here. Laura, so where does your substance abuse take you ultimately? How many more experiments with drugs did you engage in?
Well, it's sort of my drug use sort of goes hand in hand with different codependencies on boyfriends, and I won't get into that, but through different relationships that I had, we sort of had different drugs that we would get into. I got heavily into hallucinogenic drugs for quite a while as I got older and I was in college. And then eventually I learned a little bit about cocaine for a short time. And eventually I met someone that helped introduce me to opiates, although it probably is worth mentioning that I never touched a pain pill. I am not someone that was prescribed pain pills or did pain pills before trying heroin, which was ultimately my downfall. But I didn't ever try any pain pills. I just happened to be with someone that was into heroin, and he seemed to be not dying. So again, I had that same thing that happened with the marijuana when I was 14, where I thought to myself, "Hey, this person isn't dead. Maybe I won't die if I try this."
Yeah, it's among the hallmarks of the insidious nature of the disease of addiction is that it doesn't kill you until it kills you.
Yeah.
Laura's our guest on the phone. She's now celebrated just recently 15 months of sobriety, and she's taking us through that story. She's here as a member of the alumni or group put together by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, the sponsors of Recovery Radio. We have more with her and the director of that alumni group, Maggie Hunt, straight ahead. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano with you every week. Reminder, we talk about the disease of addiction, and it is all sponsored by the good people at Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. And boy, do I sound like a broken record on this one. They are a world-class organization. Just, you know, look them up. You'll see what they're thought of in the field of treating the disease of addiction. And they sponsor this program, but when I give you their phone number, I'm telling you, I give you this phone number purely as an informational tool. If you have questions or comments about anything concerning the disease of addiction or treatment or what's available or insurance or any questions at all, you can feel free to call Retreat and they will get you answers. If the answers result in them treating you, you're in the best hands possible. But if it doesn't, it doesn't. And that's the truth from the top of this organization down. Give them the phone number, Steve. We'll try to get them help. Either we'll provide it or we'll send them in the right direction. It's also a phone number that Peter Shure, the founder and CEO, has said, I hope they never have to use. And I know he means that, too. So here's the phone number. Write it down. Put it in the drawer. Nobody expects this disease to descend upon their family. But when it does, this number could be a lifesaver. 855-859-8808. That's Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. 855-859-8808. From their alumni group, Maggie Hunt is with us here in the studio. Maggie's the director of that organization, and she has arranged for us to talk periodically with people who are in successful sobriety and members of that alumni group. To that end, she has introduced us to Laura, and Laura is on the telephone with us. So, Laura, tell us about your descent. You have descended now into substance abuse that takes you all the way to heroin, right?
Yes.
Describe the dimensions of your heroin use. Was it intravenous? Tell us about that.
Well, what had happened was I never, like I had said, I never had done a pain pill, and I've never actually sniffed heroin. I went directly to needles because I figured that was the only way to do it. I wasn't really too sure. And that really quickly took me from a job that I'd held for 7 years, and I left that. I dropped out of college. I only have 9 credits to finish my degree. I dropped right out because there was something more important in front of me. And it really quickly became my entire life, from the second I took my first breath in the morning to when I would, you know, nod out to sleep at night. And, it pushed away everything in my life. I sold my car and took a backpack and decided to go with my boyfriend to live in the Kensington area of Philadelphia because I couldn't keep going to where I needed to go. The gas was too expensive, and I needed that money for drugs. So we just went straight to the heart of where all the drugs were and decided to live there and figure stuff out, which wasn't great.
You know, it's again, a remarkable aspect of this disease that it fools you into thinking you're handling it until you get to a place where you can't handle it. How rapidly in this process of heroin use were you aware that it suddenly was no longer about recreational drug use? Did you know what I mean? Were you aware that you were doing this because you had to do it now, because you didn't want to get sick?
Well, for the first couple weeks, I figured this was a fun thing, and I didn't really know what being sick was. And I had a lot of money. I had gotten a little inheritance, which was gone in about 3 months. But I those 3 months, it was still fun. And I'll never forget the first time that I learned what being sick was that the person that I was with, dating at the time, and me were in a position in which he had said to me, we've been doing this too long, and we need to stop, or we're going to be really sick. And we'd already been doing it for maybe like a month. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, sit with me in this room for 24 hours and you'll understand. And on about the 18th hour, maybe, I started to feel what withdrawal was. And I was not a fan. So I really quickly said, well, you can do this, but I'm going to go do this, and took my car and drove to get high. And he came with me because no one really likes being sick. And from that moment on, it was a constant, like, avoiding of sickness.
Yeah, it's interesting that he would make that effort to show you what the stakes were. Do you think he was trying to stop the process, or he was just telling you, here's what the ride's like? What do you think his motivation was?
I can't really speak as to what his motivation was, but I think it had something to do with, like trying to not get to a point where everything was being put on the line for just this one drug.
Right. This was just about using heroin. He was
trying to use successfully.
Yeah.
Which is very difficult.
Yeah, if not impossible. How long did that situation, how long did this abuse of heroin last for you?
About 2.5 years.
Until you decide, tell us about the moment when you realize that you got to try something else. This isn't working.
Well, I actually, after the first about year and a half, I was working as a waitress in Philadelphia and sleeping in a park. And it began to get very cold in November. And I decided that I would try to go to treatment for the first time because I had heard of people doing it. And so I went to a state-run facility, and unfortunately, I was only going there because I didn't want to be cold anymore, and I wanted to go and live with my mom again in the hopes that I would be able to use successfully again.
Yeah, it was
because I figured they would, like, clean me out, and then I would be able to use successfully.
You just wanted to get in shape so you could get high again.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. So that sounds like the family, your mom and dad, were aware of the depths to which this disease had taken you. Is that right?
They were aware, but they weren't aware until about 6 months after it started. I was really deep in the lies and the manipulation with them for a very long time. And I left pretty early after I started doing it. I was only maybe around in their house for a couple months, and then I was pretty much gone the rest of the time.
Yeah, you said that you were working as a waitress in Philadelphia, sleeping on the streets. Is that because all of the money you made as a waitress was going for drugs?
Yeah, I actually had several different ways that I would get money. As a young woman, it's not that difficult to get into less savory forms of money making in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, running different scams on people was always a favorite as well.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about your first experience with treatment.
So I went to a Pennsylvania state-run facility, which, again, I was not ready for. I was going there to get a roof over my head. And it was state-run, so it wasn't super, super nice in any way, but it was very militaristic, in which they sort of woke us up at 6:30 a.m. and marched us down to have breakfast. And if you didn't eat then you were going to wait till lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like a curfew, and there was no going outside to smoke a cigarette unless everyone went out, and there was no having lighters, and there was no holding on to your own cigarettes. It was very, very regimented, and it's not a great first treatment experience, but I think that it would have been good for someone who had been to treatment a bunch of times and wasn't getting it.
Well, it's part of the goal, as you know, is to give people order where none existed other than, you know, substance abuse. But, you know, that Marine Corps environment's not for everybody. How long did that last for you, Laura?
I was there for like 23 days, and then I got out and went to my mom's house and immediately got high, like not even a day later.
You weren't getting high when you were in the state-run facility, were you?
No.
Was there any maintenance going on then? How did you handle withdrawal?
They did do a Subutex detox.
A kind of step down, yeah.
Yeah, like a 5-day detox. And then it was a very nice detox. It was only 5 days, very rapid.
Right.
And for the particular dosages I was coming off of at that time, because I hadn't gone to the amounts that I was doing towards the end, it was very good for me at the time.
And then the minute you're out, you relapse.
Yeah, because I didn't really want to be clean at the time. I just needed to get a roof over my head.
Was that in your head as you detox, as you're clean, as you go a couple of weeks without using? Was it in your head that, great, I feel great now, I can't wait to get high again?
Yes, and I will actually tell you, my dear mother sent me $20 so that I could buy toiletries because I was coming off the streets with literally nothing. She sent me $20 so I could buy toiletries, and instead I borrowed everyone's toiletries and used the $20 as soon as I got out so that I knew that I would have money to get high as soon as I got out.
Maggie's nodding.
So, yeah.
You've heard that story, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it makes sense. You know, it probably made perfect sense to her at the time. To a normal person, they would think that, you know, well, that's crazy. What a waste of time, all of these things. But it makes perfect sense to somebody who understands.
Maggie Hunt's the director of the alumni group at Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, and one of those alumni is on the phone with us, Laura, telling us about her story of substance abuse. And now, her 15 months of sobriety. We're going to continue with that story straight ahead. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I want to thank right here, before I forget, Maggie Hunt, who's the director of the alumni group and program at Retreat. She provides us with these people who have been now successfully sober for some time, and they're always interesting, and it's always encouraging. Maggie, thanks for introducing us to Laura, who's on the phone with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So Laura, let's. I want to get you to the process of sobriety. You know, you're 15 months sober now. You know, you were in and out of a couple of treatment facilities, relapsed once or twice. Take me to the moment where you go, all right, I got to try again. This is still not working. And through that process of slow sobriety, what happened that changed for you?
Well, essentially what happened is I had gone to a retreat, actually, and I had come down to Florida, and it worked very well for me. I was doing very well. I had gotten a job and moved out of the halfway house that I was in. And after a period of sobriety, a little over a year, I thought that I could drink like a normal person because I had some time of abstinence. And that for me was not true. And I more or less went completely off the rails with some alcohol and cocaine usage in Florida, unlike a normal person, because when you're sitting in a room with a bunch of people that you're drinking with and you're all having a good time and you're like, hey, let me teach you how to freebase, people kind of look at you funny. normal people, so to speak. And after some blacked out nights that I had had, my current boyfriend at the time had to actually go to the hospital for liver failure from alcoholism. And it sort of woke me up to like, maybe this isn't a sustainable life for me. And I was faced with losing my house and my job. Again, this is only after about 3 weeks of drinking. I was faced with losing my house and my job and everything around me, my car. And it wasn't looking great for me at all. So I had a moment of desperation, or as you might want to call it, a moment of clarity, in which I realized that to be sober was the only life that I really, really enjoyed. I didn't enjoy the using. The moment of clarity gave me a moment where I was like, wow, you know, that stuff I had been doing for a year was when I was the happiest. And I decided I wanted to do anything to go back to that. So I turned back to the only thing that had worked for me before, which was a 12-step fellowship, and re-immersed myself back into that. I did not go to treatment this most recent time. I gathered support from all the people that were around me, and it was very, very difficult, but doable, and I got to pull my life back on track.
Well, that's great. And 15 months is evidence of that, support being the key word in that whole description. Is there any doubt in your mind, Laura, that you could not maintain your sobriety unless you had the support of other people around you?
Yeah. I mean, there's been many days where I didn't know in the beginning, when I didn't know like how I was going to continue doing what I was doing, especially the industry I work in as a waitress still, mm-hmm. is something in which alcohol is around me at all times, and I didn't know some days how I was going to deal with that, but with the support of other people around me, it definitely made it a lot easier.
You're going to ask you a silly question, at least It may sound silly, but are you confident that you can remain sober now? What's your confidence level?
So my confidence level comes a lot from the fact that I did have a relapse, because my main reservation with staying sober was always, oh, well, someday after being sober for a while, I'll be able to drink and maybe smoke that weed that I love so much again. And so after actually having a period of sobriety and trying that, I now realize that my only option for a happy life is to be completely abstinent of all drugs and alcohol, which sounds so difficult when you look at it on the big picture. But as you do it day by day, the days just sort of add up, and you realize how happy you are, and you just don't really think about the big picture as much.
Well, you know, the one day at a time is a cliche, but all cliches are true. That's how they become cliches. So, yeah, you know, you're right. Big picture can go away when you're just focusing on right now. Maggie, before we say goodbye, Laura, we're running out of time here today. This is the role of part of the role of the alumni group, right? That support notion?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially like building, you know, friendships with people who are in sobriety, like right when you get out of treatment. It's almost like when you know, if you've been through any kind of disaster with someone, you might not know that person, but you've been through a similar experience. And that is what bonds you. And that's what kind of bonds the alumni. And then a friendship can like take off after that.
Laura, is that the way you see it?
Yes, absolutely. I think that the support of your peers is one of the most important things that's helped keep me sober to this day.
Well, congratulations and continued success. We wish that for you, and we appreciate your candor coming on the program. I'll tell you this, this is just my observation. I've talked to so many people who are recovering and working at it, and they all have the same kind of quality of their voice. It's very strong and very hopeful, and I hear it in you, Laura, so, you know, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Mag, come back again. We'll do another.
Yeah, thanks so much. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
Everybody, enjoy the rest of your weekend, and look for us on Saturday, Recovery Radio. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.